Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is David Isco. David comes with a great background to talk about one of my favorite topics, was humor. I don't have it. I don't have the ability to tell a joke if it would save my life. However, I love it when I can run across somebody who can tell a joke. But where is humor? Where does it come from? What it's all about? And what are its different forms? And how has David, who is a comedy writer, a comedy performer, and a comedy producer, how does he define it, and what has it done in his life? David Isco, With Respect. David, how are you today?
I'm doing well, alive and well, full of thoughts, ready to speak.
All right, okay. But before we find out about humor, where do you come from originally?
Well, I'm from Washington, D.C., although I've been in New York City long enough that most people say they're from New York by this point.
How many weeks, months, years does it take for you or for anybody coming to New York to become a New Yorker?
So, from most people I know, it's about a year or two. I still don't feel like a New Yorker after, 8.5 years of full-time New York living and another 4 years of part-time.
What borough do you live in?
I live in Brooklyn, the County of Kings.
I know one of my law partner's daughter lives in Brooklyn and has moved in several parts of Brooklyn, but likes it very much there. It's a reviving community, as I understand.
It is, in some ways, a reviving community, and in other places, it's a disappearing community.
Oh, and really? Why?
Well, a lot of parts of Brooklyn are being bought by developers, and developers develop land in a certain direction, and sometimes a neighborhood where a lot of people knew each other and formed a local culture is not able to afford the developer's vision of that same neighborhood. I'm actually in one of those neighborhoods right now. I've been in the same neighborhood ever since I moved to New York, so 8.5 years. I've been on the same block. I moved once. I moved next door to the building next door.
This sounds very much like the movie 2 Weeks Notice, where the Sandra Bullock and Hugh Grant played off of each other, and about a developer versus a community organizer, so to speak. And it was about the tearing down of a building. Of an old building that Sandra Bullock and her family were looking to keep, a community center, but it was just a conflict of cultures and business and whatnot. But turned into a great comedy. I enjoyed it very much.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there are lots of those types of stories, more or less comedic, happening all over Brooklyn, which is a city as large as Chicago individually. As a borough, it has about the population of Chicago.
Wow. Well, all right. So, you're originally from Washington. Tell me something about your family.
So, my family, my parents are both government lawyers and both career lawyers, so non-political. My mom has worked in the Office of Legal Counsel and under several presidents, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and now the current administration.
Mm-hmm.
And My father, prosecutor, and then a judge. So I come from a fairly overrepresented group in comedy and most forms of media, which is the sort of the upper middle class, lower upper crust.
And so you got a lot of, you had a lot of material in your upbringing, you poor thing. But they gave you, just think of all the things that you got out of this. You know, lawyer jokes are they're gold. They're dying, you know. It replaces.
My parents have a few books of lawyer jokes around the house. That was sort of my first introduction to classic joke book style jokes.
I'm waiting for the day. We've eliminated ethnic jokes. We've eliminated all racial jokes. We've eliminated gender jokes. But no one has taken up the cudgel for lawyers to say you can't pick on poor lawyers. I'm waiting for the day when our time comes.
Yeah, that's a classic thing, in that people, you always want the same protections for a thing you choose as people get for what they're born into. But
that's right.
I see the instinct. You know, you are who you are, and
so how did you escape being a lawyer? You got a mom and a dad who are lawyers, and how did you escape?
I think. I never doubted that I could be a lawyer, and you always grow up in these communities with you want to exceed expectations, and so there seemed to be no way to exceed expectations by being a lawyer. I don't know if that's it. I think I always wanted to learn new things and amuse myself and my friends more than I wanted to do anything else. So I've sort of happened down that path, sort of denying that it was my career aspiration, but falling into it anyway. Like a lot of times in class, I'd be in the back of the class doing enough to keep up, you know, pass the test, but I would be writing stuff on my laptop or in my notebooks, just humorous things that came to mind, and eventually that sort of turned into a career.
No, but you weren't the class clown, though, I bet.
It was, at times, I wasn't like the loud vocal class clown, but I was kind of like the, sometimes the smart aleck class clown, or I would do things like I'd print something out and bring it around and pass it out to friends. I had this when I worked when I went to school. I've been out of school so long that I think of any place where I go and go every day is work. When I went to high school, I created this paper called the Wilson Crapper, and it was supposed to be toilet reading, and it was sort of my take on The Onion.
Oh.
And with local hyper-local stories specific to the school, and pass it around to friends, and then my dad found it and got worried that I was going to get in trouble and shut it down. And that story became my college essay.
How your father thwarted your career?
how I had this, that was part of it. Yeah, my father's thwarting my career.
Yeah.
I think my focus was my small attempt at unprofitable entrepreneurship.
All right. Well, at some point you left the warm confines of Washington, D.C., says he, having been there and known that it's not necessarily warm except during the summertime.
Oh, yeah, but it's very
warm. Unavoidably warm. But at any rate, so you left. Eventually, where'd you go to school, and how'd you get in New York?
So, one answer to both questions, I went to school at Columbia University in the city of New York, which is the full name. And I guess the full name of my program was Columbia College at Columbia University in the city of New York. And I went there because, again, with sort of the expectations of my class and background and having been a sort of high-achieving student, everyone expected me to go to a fancy school. And I went and visited and didn't like most of them, but I had a good experience visiting Columbia, and some funny kids from my high school who I was friends with were also going to Columbia, and I thought, well, this is seems like a fun place. It also seemed like a place where people were interested in a lot of abstract discussions of philosophy and various sort of topics of interest, but not of much use, which is kind of my specialty. So anyway, I applied. I sent them my Wilson Crapper essay, and I got in.
Your father must have been so proud.
I think he was, and that you sort of wonder if someone who has these not necessarily productive but fairly creative pursuits will ever get any sort of recognition from the more respected institutions for them. So
like
I think
parent.
He was surprised
like
and relieved, but not that surprised.
All right, so Columbia. All right, then what happened after Columbia?
So while I was at Columbia, I had started writing comedy. And this does lead into what happened after Columbia. At some point, I applied to write part-time for The Onion to contribute headlines to their video division.
Mm-hmm.
And during my senior year, I got an offer to come in once a day to the office to actually participate in a writer's meeting and bring it once, to say once a day? Once a week for a 3-hour writer's meeting and actually write scripts for them.
Okay, so what's, you know, there's a number of us who were aspiring humorists in our grammar school or our high school or whatever, and just it all died out. But I've always loved things like I've heard about and like the Onion. Tell me, what is the Onion? Because some of our listeners may not know about it.
So the Onion is a satirical news organization. It started as a satirical paper. So they would publish things that looked like newspapers, but all the news would be made up.
Fake news?
Fake news. Before fake news was actually designed to fool people. This was just designed to amuse people who would understand that it was fake and understand the real thing, that it was sane.
Mm-hmm. So how did you got involved in the writer's meeting? Now, what does that mean? I've heard writer's meetings in comedy show preparation on television, but I don't know how it would apply in at The Onion.
So I started writing for the video division, which had recently launched. So The Onion went from just being a paper where all the articles would take the newspaper form to having these short clips that looked like cable news and had fake stories. So, like one example that one of my friends had done of an Onion News Network story was about an anonymous donor who came in, a great philanthropist, who delivered 500 kidneys to a hospital. And you see this visual image, this security footage, this sliding door at the hospital opens, someone throws in a bag of 500 human kidneys, and then later the doctors are sorting them out, and they talk about what a great philanthropist this man is, and how generous, and how much they can do with it, and they gloss over the obvious question of where one person got 500 human kidneys that weren't.
Yeah, that sounds like one of those old urban legends about a guy goes into a hotel and wakes up in the morning and his back has been sliced and he's given up a kidney.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so you imagine there are hundreds of such stories and maybe not all of the people woke up.
Yeah. So where did that develop into?
So that later developed into shows. But to get back to the question you did ask, the writers' meeting at the time, we'd bring in, we'd had a writers' group of probably 8 to 12 people, and we'd each bring in a script and in the meeting, we'd read all the scripts out loud. We'd do what's called a table read, and then people would give notes. They'd propose punch-ups, which are ways to make it funnier. We'd try to work through the problems. We'd talk about who the target is of the joke. Are we hitting the target the right way? Is this a target we should be choosing? Are we saying the right thing about it? All those sort of things. And we'd come back and we'd rewrite them and sometimes give table reads on the rewrites. And so that was it. It was 3 hours to rework as many of these scripts as we could. And eventually, maybe 1 in 12 would end up being shot and aired.
Oh, wow. Now, talk about not seeing the product of your work often. That's quite something. Listen, we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to David Isco, who's a comedy writer, comedy performer. We're going to be talking about that in a little bit. But we want to talk about the nature of comedy, too, and all of its different forms. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with David Isco, whose world has been comedy ever since he decided that genetically he was not programmed to be a lawyer, or that he wanted to do something else. So, this is, as I say, John Smetanka. Now, David, you got this experience working with The Onion as, I guess, was that an intern or a paid position or what?
It was an infrequently paid position. They did end up, for me, paying me every time that I did what I was supposed to do, every time they were supposed to. So it wasn't infrequently paid. It was not inconsistently paid.
All right, there you go.
You were paid only if they used your ideas originally, and then when I got brought into the writer's room, they'd pay a small fee for the meeting, but you'd get paid a lot more if they actually produced your script.
So, where did it go from there?
So, from there, it went a few different directions. I had a career on and off with The Onion because they needed more people when they had certain projects. I was a full-time staff writer on a TV show. I was a head writer of another web series. Then they relaunched video in New York, and I was a senior writer on staff. But in between all those different stints with The Onion, I did various side projects in comedy, and I took various day jobs or temporary jobs.
Like what?
So my first job in New York, my first full-time job was as an EMT.
Did you bring in a lot of kidneys?
I never found a kidney. There were some people who we took care of that had gotten kidneys, but we weren't the suppliers of kidneys. EMTs don't generally do much in the way of advanced medical care.
All right.
They did, when we were at the training, the EMT training class, they said, you treat with diesel, which I took to mean... This is my understanding when they said that at first, is a lot of people are going to die, so you end up having to burn them. That is not what they meant. What they meant is the way you treat them is by loading them into the ambulance and going. Load and go as quickly as you can, and you use diesel to power an ambulance.
All right. Well, that makes me feel a little bit better about if I ever have an EMT experience.
Yeah.
So what else did you do?
So I was an EMT. I was I trained for a couple weeks to be a reviewer of ad engagement for a small branch of Nielsen. And then as soon as I had completed the training, I got a full-time job on a TV show and I had to quit. I was a clerk with the New York Post, which was interesting. I did not really want to be a reporter there, but I wanted to see what went on. I was an other clerk at a title insurance company, and I started an underground subversive newsletter while I was there. I worked for a startup, and I've done various temp jobs. I've done, like, just this week, I was in a check-in person for a cruise, a yacht booze cruise.
Yeah.
Or a Christmas party. So things like that, those are...
Well, they keep body and soul together, but it also gives you a wide range of humor possibilities, because if you see people getting on and off of a cruise boat, a booze cruise, you're going to get a different aspect of human nature than you're going to see as an EMT, and so on, and it got to build into something, some kind of a repertoire, if you will, or at least a treasury of human nature that you can have fun with.
Exactly. Yes. And that's one of the things I try to take away from every job, is some observation about how people are in different circumstances in their life, in different phases of their life, and what kind of characters populate different parts of our world.
Did you ever take up the idea of being a stand-up comedian yourself, or an actor, a comedy actor?
I've done both. I have not gotten paid for either of those things, but I've done both of them, and I enjoy them. And I would say stand-up is probably the hardest form of comedy.
Really? Now, I would have thought that it's just great. Get up there in front of an audience and tell them funny stories, and you're off to the races, and they're happy. Or they throw bottles. What am I saying? You know.
Yeah. So that either of those things could happen. You were hinting earlier at the idea of where humor comes from.
Right.
And it comes from a lot of different places. But I think one thing that is consistent between a lot of the laughs you get is that it subverts some kind of expectation in a way that you're ultimately comfortable with. And in most forms of comedy, the expectation is clearly established by other people. If you're in a show and you're an actor, someone has written the show and they framed the show and they've directed it. So by the time you step on stage, people know who you are and they know what to expect from the character. And then you read the line that subverts the expectation.
All right.
When you're a writer, you still get to, like, if you're an Onion writer, you're playing off the expectation of what people read in the news. So they know what kind of headlines they expect, and then you take a familiar headline and subvert it. If you're a stand-up comedian, you have to form the audience's full expectation, and you have to set the context yourself, because the context of a person getting in front of you and telling a joke is not inherently funny.
So I was walking down the street one day, and I saw this bus, and it had only three wheels, and it kind of hopped along, and then the kids got off, and they were all seasick. How do I make funny out of that?
Oh, huh.
I mean, is that so? I've seen stand-up comedians on the Comedy Channel, and of course on television, the various evening shows. For years and years and years, and never would I have the courage to stand up in front of that audience and try to be funny. But I admire the people who can do it and who can make me laugh. So I'm just setting up a situation. What would your comedy routine sound like, maybe?
Ooh, it's actually, it takes a long time for me to steel myself for a stand-up routine. So because I'm at ease right now and talking to you, I feel naturally reluctant to get into this whole mood. So, yeah, I can't do it.
Well, but the point I was coming at is there is a process whereby you translate your observation that is common to everybody. whether it is the old stand-up, how is my mother-in-law compared to what, you take that, the common experience that people have with their in-laws, or with money, or with spouses, or with children, or with politicians, or with lawyers, and they all have this, there's sort of a commonality there that that people have, and you're going to subvert their expectations. What do you mean by subverting their expectations?
Well, it can happen on a lot of different levels. So great observational comics will see something about this familiar thing that you did not see. So it'll be some situation you've gone through time and time again, and maybe something about it has bothered you, but you don't know exactly what it is. And the observational comic will pinpoint that thing.
Okay, I can see that.
Then there are also one-liner punchline comics who are just subverting your expectation on a much smaller level about what the words that they're saying are going to mean. So, like, there's Steve Wright, the stand-up comedian, like, I poured spot remover on my dog. He disappeared.
You see? There you go.
So it subverted your understanding of spot remover. That's not a grand thing about life, but it's, you know, if you can consistently surprise and vary the pace of those type of jokes, you can make a career out of it. Mitch Hedberg was another great one-liner comic.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of, was it Maury Amsterdam? But there was, who was this other guy who, I get no respect. I just don't get no respect.
Oh, Rodney Dangerfield.
Right, there you go. Rodney Dangerfield. Yeah. And he's just, he just goes one after the other, after the other, after the other. And it just seems like a never-ending torrent of putting himself down. And maybe, what do they do, play into the subconscious inferiority complexes that we all bear as we're sitting in the audience?
Yes, I think that's very true. And I think what's one thing that's surprising about that, and now probably by this point it's not surprising because you're so used to seeing comedians do that, but usually when people get on stage and talk about themselves, they play themselves up. So you're naturally expecting people to brag or try to present themselves in the best light because, you know, we want to present our best selves to other humans. So the self-deprecation comes as a type of surprise, and it also does surprise people to recognize something in themselves that the other person is embodying and taking a hit for. So there's that laugh of relief in a way that, oh, Rodney is taking the hit for this anxiety I feel.
Well, you know, that's interesting because I'm now listening to a book tape, Abraham Lincoln, The Prairie Years and the War Years by Carl Sandburg. And one of the things that Sandburg highlights over and over again is how Lincoln prepared assiduously, hard work over and over about delivering one-liners.
Oh, really?
And or that he would use humor to calm an angry audience or to take somebody who was on the other side of the argument, pompous and expressed himself in shouting, and took him down a notch by just being humorous and telling an old story about the farmer who walked into the field and so on and so forth. And some of his, there was using humor as a tool for political speech. And it's something of what you're talking about because a comic takes on the role of sort of anti-politician, i.e., wants to use humor to punch holes in perhaps the inconsistencies of a political candidate's ideas, or ideas versus their behavior. It can be very effective.
Yes, it's true. And yet it can be very complicated because different types of politicians rely on different types of authority. So, for example, in the moral majority years, mm-hmm. where conservative politicians tended to conduct themselves with sanctimony, and that was kind of a tool of their power. You could make a lot of hay and sort of take them down by pointing out the inconsistencies or places where they might be immoral. For mm-hmm. certain types of politicians, more dictatorial, authoritarian types, inconsistency doesn't really harm them. They do not rely on consistency. They rely on bigness, omnipresence, being interesting, people attending to their needs and whims. And I read recently, and this was before I had perceived a big authoritarian threat on the scale in our country that we're dealing with now. But a few years ago, I'd picked up this book on Soviet Union, the humor in the Soviet Union during the Stalin years, and they talked about what kind of jokes were tolerated and what weren't, and jokes that made Stalin look like a jerk, a terrible person, a murderer, immoral, were generally tolerated because you didn't obey Stalin because he was good, you obeyed him because he was powerful.
That's fascinating. Holy mackerel. Before you go on, I've got to take a break right now. Come back and we'll talk about that, because I have a, not a Stalin joke, but a Putin joke I heard in Europe, and I want to tell you and see what see how you can dissect it. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and we're talking to David Isco, who is a comedian, a comedy writer, performer, and just a studier of humor and comedy in our lives. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with David Isco, comedy writer, comedy purveyor, comedy everything. That's part of his life. This is John Smetanka. Now, David, before we broke, I teased you with this, and I heard this joke a couple of years ago in the Czech Republic, and it goes like this. This is what the Czechs, how they tease the Russians. Seems that there's a town called Karlovy Vary, which is a spa town going back to the old Austro-Hungarian days, and it's a very beautiful spa town. And with all the new money, oil money and whatever other kinds of money, there are many Russian oligarchs who have moved into Karlovy Vary and basically own the town. So the story goes that Putin called up President Klaus and said, you know, if you don't allow us to come in and take over the eastern half of the Czech Republic, we're going to bomb and we're just going to come in. And so President Klaus said, if you come in, the first Soviet Russian soldier that comes in, we will burn Karlovy Vary. At which point there was no assault. And this sort of mocking of the acquisition of the reality of the acquisition of a lot of Czech territory when it was done with military force versus buying towns is kind of, that's something that they react to. And it was a great story. I thought it was very funny, told better than I did it, but it is the injection of humor. How would you define it? Am I using that in the Russian sense that you just described, in the Soviet sense, of it's okay to say bad things because we assume he's bad or something like that?
This is interesting because it's a little different dynamic than being in Russia and making fun of your leader. You're making fun of the Russians who are occupying. Yeah, I don't know. So who would you say the target is of that joke?
Well, the target, I think, for the Czechs is Russians who come in and take over part of their economy and their land and their buildings, yeah, and their humor, and their whatever.
I think that's a bit of, yeah, and so it seems to me like that's a bit of gallows humor, which is, you know, common in places where you don't have much of a chance to change your situation. You can at least name it.
Uh-huh. Why do we crave humor? What is, you know, it seems to be, you know, philosophers going back to Aristotle talk about human beings. I think the phrase was in Latin, animal risibilis, which is the animal that is able to laugh. And
yes.
But we crave it. It's a part of our, I found very few people who cannot bring a smile or cannot smile at a joke. Some of them, yeah, maybe some of them. But as the general rule in human nature, we like jokes. We like humor. What's the, why? Why do we like it so much?
So, yeah, it's, human mind is always very complicated. But I don't know if I can answer the question fully, but I can give some possible explanations, or at least some part of the answer. And so I find that a lot of humor is from expectations being defied. Some of it is relief, like I talked about, oh, Rodney's taking the hit, I'm not. It's humor is laughing is pleasurable, and you have a pleasurable response to lead your brain to reward you for getting to a place you're supposed to be, and so you'll seek out pleasure. And I think there is a lot of benefit in shifting perspectives and understanding things in different ways. And somehow it became evolutionarily advantageous to think laterally, to get out of anxious loops or narrow thinking. And that discovery is rewarded with this pleasurable feeling, this absurd, funny feeling that produces the laugh. That's what I think. But, you know, who knows?
Well, you know, we're learning today. One of those studies, or several of those studies that we get five times a day from the internet or from television or whatever, that tells us that coffee is good for us, coffee is bad for us, sugar is good for us, sugar is bad for us, and back and forth depends on who we think, who pays for the study. But we also are now finding that humor and laughing is therapeutic.
Yes.
To our bodies and our souls.
Yes, it is. And it's, we should look for a few reasons, look for a reason to laugh. And one is that if you're not finding anything interesting or new every day, then life tends to get stale. And things that make you laugh will feel interesting and new in some way, even if they're also familiar in other ways. And also, yeah, it feels good, and it you know, it does. Feeling good is actually
it's contagious.
Good for your health.
It's,
so,
it's contagious. It is contagious not only to the person who's listening to the joke, but the person who tells the joke and gets the reaction of humor, of laughter. I think that is the few times that I was able to tell something funny. It's generally in sort of unexpected, because everybody expects me to be boring, which of course I am. But the few times I get something where people start laughing, oh, that just gets me going. Absolutely gets me going, and I can be funnier when I have a receptive audience. Just like I would imagine if when you're doing stand-up comedy, that if you've got a good audience, you just warm to it. If you've got an audience that you suspect is pulling out the bananas and the apple, rotten apples and tomatoes, it's going to be much harder for you.
Yes, completely. And I can say from both sides, you know, having... Well, not only from having had both experiences as a comedian, but also from sitting in the audience, when you see a comedian, same comedian, if there is an audience that's responding to them, they give you so much more because they know that they're going to get the response, and it's a worthwhile endeavor for them. and they'll run over their time. Like, I saw Norm Macdonald, who is one of the all-time great stand-ups, with my family in New York. And at some point during this show, it had been going on for about an hour, 45 minutes, and he says, I hate to break it to you, but the show ended 15 minutes ago. And he talks about how this light has been on, and they've been glaring at him. And while he's currently in this great warm moment with his audience, as soon as he walks off stage, he'll be harangued by the club. But he has the shield of this audience that is laughing at him and loving him, and they don't dare upset him in that moment.
Well, you know, it's like when the contrary experience when you have an arguing a case in front of the Court of Appeals, and it tends to be the Court of Appeals everywhere. They have red, green, and yellow lights in front of you.
Oh, really?
And, oh, yeah. And so while you're speaking, you're allotted 15 minutes, let's say, and when you get to about 10 minutes, the yellow light goes on. And then all of a sudden, your mind starts racing to try to finish the points you want to make. And finally, you see you're waiting, and there goes the red light, and you just, what do I do? At that point, whatever you start to say makes no sense because you're under such pressure. The red light is on. Maybe we should have red lights for comedians. I don't know.
There are those lights for comedians.
Are there really?
At open mics and places where they're most of the audience is comedians, people frequently reference it. Oh, I'm getting the light. I think a lot of comedians would be very entertained to learn that big-time lawyers making real arguments with actual weight to their decisions face some of the same pressures.
That's right. Absolutely true. Now, I'm going to toss out something, and that is religion and the meaning of humor in religion. I'm going to toss that out because I'm thinking of two different books.
Sorry.
And those two books, one is a book by Umberto Eco called The Name of the Rose. And it's set in the Middle Ages, and it's the gist of it is, why are there murders at this particular monastery in the mountains of Italy? And the answer is, eventually, I'm going to give a spoiler here, that one of the monks who's in charge of the library has found several old unknown books, previously unknown books by Aristotle, in which he talks about the value of humor. And this monk, who is a gnarled, mean, nasty old fellow who lives in a corner in this old monastery, does not believe that humor has a part in religion, and he takes that as an affront to God and to true somber religion. And so he hides these books away from everybody else in the monastery, and instead of being an area of learning about the depth of humanity and its relation to the divine, he tries to crib and to cripple and take away that aspect of human life, which is, I think, so important in all parts. And the other piece of literature is a play called J.B., put on by or created by Archibald MacLeish. And in one line in there, the God figure and the devil figure in this allegory based on Job. The devil figure says, nowhere in the scripture do you find that God laughed. God does not laugh. There's no humor with God. Well, I tend to find that to be ridiculous because if God created everything, he created humor.
Right.
He looks at me, if he doesn't laugh at me, then the whole thing is true, that there is no humor, because I am the perfect foil for the Lord on high as far as being odd and stupid and do crazy things and unexpected things. But
yeah,
at any
we
rate,
all are.
But religion, you talked a little bit earlier about the time in the Christian Rite in politics. I will tell you that there were people that, just like you described, that they were so serious and they needed a pin to their to their balloons. But on the other hand, there was a good deal of humor also. It wasn't quite the humor that I grew up with, but it was humor, even among the most of the most religious of the politicians. So it's interesting that we have different things that we laugh about and different things that are forbidden to be laughed about.
Right, right. Yes. I don't know. That's, I think, true and fascinating. As far as religious humor, I'm most familiar with Jewish humor. I was raised Jewish, and my dad's side of the family are all Jews. There are a lot of Jewish jokes and that are more cultural than religious. And I noticed some running themes through them that are basically the unanswerability of everything. And I think it's interesting. There are certain, there are among religious Jews, there are many humorless factions. But I think the most common experience is of people just sort of going through life and having a lot of things happen to you and kind of having to laugh at it and accept it and realize things are outside your control. And I think it's interesting that, yeah, it's religions and any sort of institution do tend to reflect lived experience. So the culture and the religion itself, because religion is practiced communally and by individuals, in some ways is inseparable. But I'll give an example of a sort of Jewish joke that my grandpa would always tell. And I think it was always sort of kind of instructive about the reactions that we young people, his grandchildren, would experience in our various pursuits. So he talks about Albert Einstein going back to his parents to talk about all the things that he's discovered. And he said, well, I've discovered that mass and energy are the same. And I've discovered that physics is relative. And so he's explaining all these things that he's done. And his parents say, well, that's great, Albert, but tell me this. From all this, you make a living?
All right. We're going to take a break right now. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about the different kinds of humor that different that appeal to different people. And we'll be testing David on his favorite comedians and favorite types of humor. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and we will be right back. We're now back in With Respect with David Isco, who is a comedian and a studier of a scholar of comedy. He studied at great university, Columbia University, in the city of New York. And this is John Smetanka, and on With Respect, we're talking funny today. So, David.
Yes.
There are some areas that you cannot laugh about. You can laugh in your own group about yourselves, but you can't do the same if it's outside your group. So men can tell jokes that they wouldn't dare tell to women, or women wouldn't find funny, and vice versa. And groups, you mentioned the Jewish community, has jokes that are most appreciated because they reflect real cultural factors in their own lives and so on. You can make all the various groups that are composed of our society. But there are common things that we can laugh about and common ways to tell jokes or to produce humor. And I want to talk about a couple of my favorites. I found President Jack Kennedy to be one of the great users of humor in making points and in relieving tension and in bringing people along with him during his press conferences, for example. If people made collages of his humor that are still funny to this day, and it's the way he would make a comment or a flip off a remark, a witticism, that there was an amusement in his eyes that and a little smile that that captured people. But I'm going to toss out to you the various kinds of humor that I know of, and you can add to it or subtract from it. Wit, the witty remark, the joke teller, situation comedies on where it's acted out on television or in a play or whatever, and it's the situation itself which brings humor. Satire, making fun of some vulnerable, because they are, say, pompous individuals. And as I say, there's then the mocking humor of the self-mockers and the mockers of others. Don Rickles made a whole career on that. What are your thoughts on these guys that are there's various kinds of humor? And if I missed some?
We always are missing types of humor. So there's the humor of restating the obvious that is not being acknowledged. That's one. I think like Norm Macdonald is sort of good at that. He says the ideal joke is the punchline is the same as the setup. You didn't realize it was right under your nose. There is a very broad visual physical humor that you see in stuff like the Three Stooges or in cartoons like Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner. And I think those things are great because it's so universal and objective, like what you see coming, and it's like broad humor, like good broad humor is great and so useful and spans a lot of different categories. But I wanted to go back to a thing that you had said. You were talking about mocking humor, and I think it's very interesting, groups mocking themselves, and you're talking about people who put down others. So Don Rickles, I think everyone loved being made fun of by Don Rickles because you knew that him putting you down had nothing to do with you because he did it to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
So there was kind of a love behind it, and you were never made to feel like it was anything uniquely wrong about you, but it's just seeing a master work his craft, and this time you're the subject.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There is a type of mocking humor that I think is less fun for most people, but it's where a powerful group or someone with some sort of power or status over someone else mocks the people they have status over. It's popular. You get it sometimes thinly disguised, and it's broadly called punching down. Although who's down and who's up is sort of a complicated situation, and what a punch is complicated. But in general, there is, you talk about things, there are things that Jewish people can tell about themselves that in certain climates told by other people would be perceived as an attack, and rightly so, because it would reinforce the power that someone else has through anti-Semitic strains in society. And in the U.S., Jews are not as much on the lower end of a lot of these power dynamics, but a lot of groups are. And I think rightly so, they can say a thing is not funny to them because the attack overwhelms whatever structural surprise could be in there. The threat is real. It's not just a joke.
What about Your favorite comedians. Now, you've mentioned a few, but I'd be interested in hearing some of the other range of people that you find funny.
So, yeah, let's see. I think among stand-ups, Norm MacDonald, I had mentioned, and then another one stand-up I really like is Maria Bamford. She did this a few years ago now, this stand-up special. She has dealt with a lot of depression, social anxiety, and things like that. And a lot of her jokes revolve around that. So she did a stand-up special in her own home. And she's got the stage set up. She's got a big sign with lights on. And the only people in the audience are her parents sitting on a couch.
Uh-huh.
And she delivers it right to them. And it's funny. She had one point where she talks about her family, and she says, "So, my family. Oh, you are my family." but I thought, and it was interesting. It was the same joke she tells to other people, but the context revealed sort of a lot about who she was, and the jokes take on a different context, and it does sort of. She was playing up, but like really exploring sort of her own timidity.
Mm-hmm.
But also the tremendous braveness of saying jokes in front of the people you're probably most scared to reveal yourself around.
Sure. If you have problems with your own identity or who you are or why you feel badly, sometimes people tend to say it's all their parents' fault. And if you start making fun of yourself in front of your parents, that's gutsy.
Yeah.
But you know, we have so many other people out there. And the other thing I was going to mention before we run out of time is there is such a thing, too, as time humor. That is, what is funny 20 years ago or 40 years ago or 100 years ago may not always be funny today. And I can think of some of the old movies, the comedy movies that I've seen that don't have the same ring, that they don't produce the same laughs that they do today. Where is comedy going today?
Ooh, yeah. If I could answer that one, I might be there at the place it's going.
Be there before the train comes in.
Yeah. I think it's, right now, it's one of the trends is fragmentation of market. So, people are, now that there are so many entertainment options, you can sort of be right in the middle for a group and reflect the direct shared experience really well. So there's, in one sense, a lot of micro-targeting. And that will be a trend. I think people on some level will sort of get tired of it. So there is going to be an opportunity at some point. You know, things always ebb and flow, and people get tired of a certain thing and then want something new. And there's some great short story. There's a great short story by this guy, John Milhauser, about how fashion works that way, and he's projected it into the future. So anyway, I think at some point there'll be an opportunity for unifying humor that has broad intersubjective appeal will pop up, and someone will be great at that. So it's going to move rapidly in a lot of different directions. And I think the only advice I can give anyone is find something that you really care about and that does amuse you in some circle of people, get good at it, and wait for the moment to arrive and recognize the moment when it arrives.
David Isco, it's been a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun talking about not just the reality of comedy, but some of its theory and how it's put together and the writers' groups and so on. So, David, thank you very much for joining us. And remember, folks, we're on every Sunday and Thursday. And if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.
Thank you, John.